Tune in to The Queer Truth, a podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I am Chantel C. You can call me CC. And I'm joined by my partner in organizing, but only if you promise there will be no drama. Do you promise there will be no drama? Look into my eyes.
I am a messy bitch that lives for scamming. Where does that whole meme go? All of that. I live for drama.
So for those of you who may not know what I was trying to quote there, that is from an amazing movie called Tangerine that was big, very big last year in 2015 at the Sundance Film Festival. And Maya Taylor was the breakout actress who played Alexandra in that film. Maya just spent a day or a few hours on Thursday with a Twitter organized town hall, hashtag My Story Out Loud. Maya teamed up with Youth Resource, which is a program of advocates for youth, and they invited people to join in the conversation and discuss what is happening in schools around the country. What can people learn to better support LGBTQ youth of color? I think this is amazing. I was excited to see that Maya was a part of it. If you go to the hashtag and look at it, it's still even going on now. They're asking to continue the campaign, to continue asking your questions. They plan to collate the questions and answers and to disseminate the information to organizations and institutions so that some things can change. But what I think is most interesting about this whole thing is it wouldn't be possible without technology. Technology is creating a type of activism that we've never seen before. What do you think about that, Denise?
Yeah, I think we're at a really special moment in technology where there's always been sort of this dynamism around uprisings and grassroots organizing. See something happen in one country, it seemed to just happen energetically in another country very soon after. Some of that could be because of inspiration, but some of that just has to do with the times and generations kind of coming of age together. That definitely has happened with the Black Lives Matter movement, where people in all manner of countries are referencing this movement. So it's being referenced in Canada, it's being referenced in Australia, and it's being referenced in South Africa, where very recently students were protesting, Black students in South Africa were protesting in the university there, and they were assaulted during their protest. So it's being referenced in Europe. So I think, yeah, I mean, we have a potential that we've never had before in terms of technology.
Well, how do you think technology has shifted the way we think about queerness and difference and otherness specifically?
Do I have to be politically correct?
Of course not. Like, you never are. Why would you ask today?
You know, but no, that was actually a joke, because I think that's exactly, that's one of the major things that technology has shifted, is that it has illuminated for people where they're being inconsistent and where their issues, where they're being homophobic, being racist and being whatever. And that's why we see this backlash around political correctness, because people are not used to being held accountable in this way. It used to be that you could just put your hands in someone's hair and, you know, depending on the kind of day they were having, more than likely you wouldn't get called on it.
Right.
But now, you know, you take a picture of, you know, your these conversations that white people used to have safety around, because they're just talking to other white people. And so they're saying like this heavily racist stuff or heavily homophobic stuff or whatever. Now those are available for everyone to see, and people can pull up receipts on you. Mm-hmm. So, right. So if who's the guy that criticized Cam for his response after the Super Bowl, and he said, oh, this isn't a great, that's really childish, that's not a good role model for the kids. But this guy had sex with a teenage girl on camera. He's an actor. Of course, no one forgets online. Like, you can't then just come online and talk about, oh, what about the kids and you a pedophile?
Oh,
you know? We know who you are, mm-hmm. right? We have done the full background check. That level of scrutiny just is not something that people are used to. It's the first time in history that people can have that level of instant scrutiny. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, you from like your techie geeky standpoint, right? There is also this...
You mean I'm hardcore, I will end you. No, I'm just kidding.
Hey. Okay. you know, there's this, what I think is really interesting about it, it's not only being able to communicate in a way that we haven't been able to do it before and to organize in a way we haven't been able to do it before, but it feels like not only on Twitter, obviously, Twitter is it's maybe not the place for that, but there's this archiving standpoint of being able to tell our stories and have them upheld somewhere so that it can't be rewritten later. And I think that's really important as well. If you think about Stonewall, the whitewashed movie, you know, in the future, it'll be a lot harder to rewrite something like that. Like, if you think about it, you won't be able to make like the All Lives Matter documentary.
Right.
It's definitely going to be the Black Lives Matter documentary just because you can't rewrite it at this stage. Or am I missing something?
I don't really know if that's true. I think, you know, I mean, like, I usually don't get involved in the comment section because they are the road to hell. But recently there was a Brookings Institute put out a study that said that something very simple that we've known since forever, that white teachers have implicit bias. They did a study, they researched it. It was basically a white paper. It didn't have a whole lot of emotional analysis about it. It was just like, look, we did the study and we found that, you know, white teachers have emotional bias, have implicit bias against Black children. And that leads to different impacts for them. So we know they have a school to pipeline thing. We know that they're dealing with higher rates of suspension and expulsion, all of these things. And white people got on the back of this and said, you know, I had a teacher that was so great and she was white, or my wife's a teacher and she's so great and she loves those children. Right. And it's because they are fed this narrative of the lone great white person can solve racism, can solve oppression. And it's repeated so often that they internalize it because they have to internalize it because the alternative is really scary for them. When your identity is built on exclusion and oppression, and you have never unpacked it, then you have to turn it into something that feels good for you. And this is how whiteness is constructed. So just recently, the Jesse Owens story came out called Race, because for those of you that don't know, Jesse Owens was during Nazi times, he raced in the Olympics, and he was a Black man. So he was dealing with segregation at home, and he raced in the Olympics and he won for the gold medal for America. This was a massive deal because at the time the Germans were talking about the white race being the superior race.
Yes, but where did he race? That's what makes it important. Where did he win?
You know what, teacher? I have missed
that. Why do we care about Nazis? It only matters because it happened in Germany.
Okay. But they did a biography of him. They did a full-on biography of his life, trying to unpack what his life... Girl, and the whole thing is about white people.
Stop it.
So, yes! The whole thing is about white people. Oh, it's about, you know, Jesse is this one-dimensional character. He races and is stoic. You know, there's like his grandma talking about him. That's the only background character that you get in terms of that. Then she never appears ever again. Mm-hmm. But you've got every white person except the Nazis that had to deal with him individually was a massively amazing person, right? Like, they were so against racism and so ahead of their time. And every white person that lives in this time likes to think of themselves that same way because they're fed this over and over. You're fed these civil rights era movies that show individual white people acting in massively heroic ways, which we know are not true. They were like a total minority of the population. For every Bernie that existed during the civil rights movement, there were so many Donalds. There were probably 10 Donalds for every Bernie, right? That was a much more common kind of scenario that, you know, a white person was much more likely to spit on your face than to shake your hand.
Right.
So that sort of collective delusion is what we're dealing with when we talk about what is necessary for whiteness to even exist as a construct and continue as a construct. It has to serve this psychological issue of cognitive dissonance. And so instead of bending what is actually happening to shape what they believe their ethics to be, and they bend the narrative, mm-hmm. right? So it's like a matrixy situation. They're like Keanu Reeves. They just, okay. You're not even really Black. We're all African, said Meryl. We're all African. And that's the end of that.
Oh, God. No, I'm not even going back to that. I'm not. Nope. We talked about it. Moving on. What was the highlight of my week was definitely the thirst trap that Director X put out.
Who, X-Men?
Oh, God.
Yeah, X-Men.
Okay. Anyway, Rihanna finally released the video for Work. Ooh, yes. I had to drink about 3 liters of water after watching it. Then I had to watch it again and drink another 2 liters of water. Yes, yes. And then they performed it live at the Brit Awards. But Director X, he said, hey guys, this isn't all about sex. In the West Indies, this is, you know, we roll up on you, we dance, and then we walk away again. Why is it so hard for people to understand that women can just, like, you know, do a little twist and a grind and not want to take it to the bedroom?
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make it about race. I mean, the Black body is so heavily sexualized, right? So all of our actions are sexualized. You know, all of our traditions, our whatever. I mean, even religious practices are sexualized. When the colonists came to Africa and they saw bare breasts, that shit was sexualized. I mean, like, our body is seen as this, you know, sexual receptacle. So, of course, you know, Rihanna's body looking cute is going to be seen as that. But she's also working with that. And, you know, the thirst for this video, I really appreciated the video. But, unlike some people, only needed to watch it once because I grew up in Brooklyn. So, you know, like, I know these parties were a part of my
life. That doesn't have anything to do with enjoying watching it. It doesn't matter where you grew up. I grew up going to Freaknik in Atlanta. That don't mean, I mean, I've seen these things.
Like the bashment. Stop it.
That's okay, you don't know the dance hall reggae scene in Atlanta. Look, but what I like about the video is you see, like, Rihanna and Drake just really enjoying each other. People trying to make it like, oh, are they back together? Oh, are they fucking again? They're just enjoying each other's company. I loved it. I'm going to continue to watch it, thirst on it. That's all right. But what I really would like to talk about is Adele winning a Brit Award for something. I don't remember. Woman, vocal, I don't know. Mm. And in her acceptance speech, she, she said she thanked her record label for accepting her as a woman. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what that means or what she exactly meant by it, but do we live in a world where we have to say, thank you for letting me be a woman, for acknowledging and embracing the fact that I'm a woman?
I think it's a poorly worded sort of thank you, because in the pop scene, what we know is that it's not so much about her being a woman that she's probably thanking them for, but for her having a non-normative body and then them promoting and getting behind her as a face, because that doesn't always happen. I mean, the record industry has a history of pushing, of prioritizing surface looks and whatever in their stars over substance at the detriment of those stars, especially the female ones. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's what she was going for.
Okay, maybe so. Well, that leads into our second segment. I had the opportunity to interview someone, and it leads into our second segment because at the end of her speech, Adele said that she'd also like to use the opportunity to openly and publicly say that she supports Kesha. So let's have a listen.
So this is Chantel C. sitting here today with the honor of interviewing Dr. Nina Burrows, who reached out to us because she found The Queer Truth and was interested in our podcast, and also has her own expertise to contribute to some of the things that we talk about. One of the issues that's super important to us that comes up time and time again. Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us.
A pleasure and an honor. I'm excited.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
So I'm a psychologist, and I spend most of my time helping people understand the psychology around sexual violence.
And why is that important?
Because for me as a psychologist, that's one of the fundamental problems. The psychology is so complicated, and if we can't understand that, that means that if we are part of the law enforcement, like, how can you apply the law if you don't understand the psychology around consent? Something like consent is a state of mind. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my work is about helping police officers, prosecutors, barristers, judges get their heads around the psychology of abuse.
Okay, well, I think your services would have been greatly appreciated just recently, as most of our listeners have probably heard about. Kesha, a well-known pop star in the U.S., just received the ruling that she has two options. She can either continue to work with the man she alleges abused her for over a decade, or she can stop working. But she is definitely bound by her contract with Sony. How do we get started unpacking this?
I don't even know where to start. I remember reading it, and I remember the judge said something along the lines of, my instinct is to do what is commercially reasonable. And I was like, oh my goodness, you might want to check in with that instinct.
Yeah.
because that's what's important here. But I guess I mean, there's the legal side of this. It is a civil case, wasn't it? It's not
right.
a criminal case.
It wasn't a criminal.
So, okay, you have perhaps as a judge different considerations, but still, as anyone on the outside, I think you're looking at this and you're thinking, oh my goodness, what is going on? And I guess from my perspective, sadly, this is something I encounter all the time because I'm not saying the psychology around sexual abuse is easy to understand, but when our law enforcement agencies don't understand it, then you end up with situations like this, which is means that when are we going to be able to deliver justice to victims if we can't understand that, unfortunately, sex offenders are smart enough to commit their crimes with no CCTV, no physical evidence. At the moment, it's unfortunately way too easy for them to continue to offend.
Well, do you think that some of the problem might derive from, even though this was a civil case, do you think that some of the problem derives from, unfortunately, the notion that over a decade, how do you let yourself be abused for over a decade? How do you sign a contract with someone who you claim abused you from pretty much the beginning? How do you move in with that person? I believe she was 16 at the time. So there is a question of a power imbalance, right?
Yeah,
that should
yeah.
be pretty obvious to any judge. But over a decade, and now she decides she can't do it anymore?
Yeah, I think, you know what, I think the fundamental thing is, of course, sexual abuse is terrifying. Like, none of us want to imagine ourselves being a victim of that kind of crime, or our children or the people we love. So we like to tell ourselves a story that it's preventable, that if that happened to us, we would stop it. We would shout, we would fight, we would get out, we would leave, and our kids would do the same. It's a story we tell ourselves about control. In a situation when, in reality, if you're that victim, by very definition, you do not have control. Somebody else is controlling you. So I think a lot of our response to abuse is really fundamentally about our own fears around the situation. We want to tell ourselves stories that sex offenders are in dark alleyways at night and all you have to do is get taxis home and watch your drink and stay with your friends. The reality of abuse is that people are abused and manipulated and exploited by people who are supposed to love them, look after them, have a duty of care for them. It's a sad reflection on our humanity, but that's the truth. So we actually like the idea, I think, that this is about violent monsters who attack strangers. We prefer that than thinking, oh, these people are abused by someone they trusted and loved and liked in a space where they should have been able to feel safe. But that's the reality for the vast majority of survivors.
Right. There was a great article that came out just today in the Women in Leadership section of The Guardian UK. And the author, Harriet Minter, was asking us to be reminded that it's not only about Keisha, right? There mm-hmm. are women who experience sexual harassment in the workplace every day
yeah.
and are faced with the decision, do I go forward or not?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I go forward, then I'm stamped
yeah.
immediately. And if I don't, if I choose to just find a different job or ignore it completely, I'm one, giving that person, the abuser, the you know, free ticket to continue abusing.
Yeah.
I'm probably not going to deal with my trauma too well. Probably just going to sweep it under the rug or find whatever strategy I can to keep going and so forth. So there's a lot of different effects around this. Some people say it's very courageous what Keisha did, but in the end, the signal from the judge is victims don't win.
Yeah, yes, it doesn't really put out a helpful message, does it? I think we're in the situation we're all in is, everybody wants there to be less sexual violence. And that means we need victims to report. If a victim doesn't report the crime, then there is no justice. So we need victims to report. The way we get to be safe and our kids get to be safe is through victims reporting so that person, the perpetrator, meets justice. But the system is set up where it is so difficult. We are asking so much of victims, a ridiculously large amount. The calls this week of, well, if you're going to claim this, where's your evidence? You know, give us physical evidence and we'll believe you. Your testimony is your evidence. Why is somebody's word, it isn't proof, but it is evidence,
mm-hmm.
and it should be taken seriously. So victims are in this very difficult situation where there's social stigma, there's a lack of convictions, it's very difficult to report. And we need our criminal justice agencies to get more creative, and we need them to start being a lot more proactive about how they investigate and prosecute these crimes.
So how do you, what is your role in that as far as supporting what some people would consider, you know, those people who've lost complete faith in the judicial system or, in, you know, law enforcement? What, how are you contributing to rebuilding that faith by educating such personnel?
So I spend a lot of my time training police officers, prosecutors, barristers, and judges, because they all also want sex offenders to meet justice. This is why police officers sign up. It's, judges believe in justice. The problem at the moment is people have a skewed idea of what a sex offender is and how they operate, and also how a victim should report and these kinds of things. So it's my job to go in and basically help them understand the psychology in a different way, help them start to think about, well, if you're a sex offender and you wanted to get away with your crime, wouldn't it be kind of smart to commit it in a, you know, closed environment that you control, and you know that injuries are, evidence, so you wouldn't, you know, you'd make sure there were no injuries. All these things. It's like, oh, if the person wants to get away with this crime, they're going to be committing these offenses in these ways where there is a lack of evidence. And also help recognizing that for lots of sex offenders, they don't actually admit to themselves that that is what they are. They want to tell themselves that they're still a good guy. So we need to understand that when a suspect says, oh, no, I had consent, they may well believe that they had consent because they want to believe that they had consent. So there's some work to do around how we interview suspects and what their testimony is. But the re-education, and actually what I really love about my job is, like, I go in, I do my thing, and then we have a conversation, and then these detectives, they're off and running because that's what they do. They like to interview suspects. It's just about helping them understand how to do that with these complicated cases.
Well, how is it possible to do what you're doing as you described it? It sounds interesting, but in a society that is built on patriarchy, for example, mm-hmm. how do you dismantle these beliefs if you're not at the same time dismantling patriarchy? Dismantling patriarchy would be too much to ask. It probably, they would be unprepared for it or would maybe even reject it, and that's not what you're there to do. So how do you address these things as they come up around consent, for example, or around how a victim should report? A lot of that does stem from patriarchy, in my opinion, and this idea of what a man and what a man's role is and what a woman's role is, mm-hmm. and all these very stereotyped gendered ideas. Are you ever faced with that? And if so, how do you work on that?
I think I'm faced with it constantly. Yeah, like that's the space. I'm always working on individual psychology, but our individual psychology is shaped by everything around us, all our experiences, our culture, our society. So, I mean, I would reflecting recently, it wasn't that long ago in the UK that judges would remind a jury that women sometimes can get confused and they can sometimes lie, and you should bear this in mind when you come to your verdict. I mean, they do not do that now, but that's our recent history,
right?
You can make the link between that and patriarchy immediately. Why is one woman's testimony not good enough? I mean, the Bill Cosby thing, why did it take 50 women?
Right.
For us to begin to think, oh, maybe they're telling the truth. So I think a lot of it is challenging. One of the challenges for my work is you're challenging people's idea of gender and power and status quo. And people don't like it when you rattle that cage. But I have to say, my particular approach is always to work with people rather than against them. And everybody in society wants there to be less sexual abuse apart from the abusers. The people I meet who are massively entwined into the concepts of patriarchy, they are big fans of justice. So if you can say that, well, this is what we're trying to do, we're trying to deliver justice and we're trying to keep our families safe, then you're talking the same language.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about, and this is just, you know, it doesn't have to be your professional opinion or anything, but there was the hashtag Free Keisha that, you know, went viral pretty quickly, and there were some big pop stars on board, like Lady Gaga, who I believe has also been quite verbal about her own abuse or experienced abuse. And, you know, big name in business, Taylor Swift gifted $250,000 to Keisha to do with whatever she wants, according to Taylor Swift. Is that any use?
I think that, you know what, I would love to live in the world where actually that kind of thing didn't happen because it didn't need to happen. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to live in the world where every victim of this crime felt able to report a criminal offence to the police. I mean, one of the interesting things for me as someone in the UK reading how sexual abuse is reported in America, you seem to have a lot more civil claims. Like, this is happening in your civil courts. Mostly here, when you hear about a celebrity or something, it is because the police have charged them with a criminal offence. So I think there's an interesting thing in the States where this is being played out, but it's not happening within your criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And I think the ideal is that our criminal justice system works and delivers justice. Part of that would be that someone is innocent until proven guilty. So this trial by media, trial by social media, all of this stuff, I think it's unhelpful, but I think it is a reflection of the fact that the system that should be working doesn't work. So I can understand why someone would not report to the police, mm-hmm. but choose to report via Twitter. I can understand, because you want some kind of justice and you want your voice to be heard. But I think the space that we should be trying to move to is one where the criminal justice system does what it's supposed to do.
Absolutely. There is a social media activist, an activist, simply activist, named Son of Baldwin, at least that's what he goes by. And he was quite frustrated that Free Keisha was this huge hashtag movement, but when it came to trying to get Straight Outta Compton boycotted, Straight Outta Compton, for those of you who don't know, was a film on kind of a biopic of NWA, which consisted of Easy, Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, and was also produced by those people. So it wasn't a true story, so to speak. It wasn't exactly the reality of the events. But Dr. Dre, who is on record and has admitted to physically abusing his then girlfriend, Michelle, he assaulted Dee Barnes in a bathroom, threw her into a wall, tried to throw her down steps and so forth. And there were others. There was this very slow moving movement online trying to bring awareness to that. And it did have some impact because, of course, Dr. Dre, who sold Beats to Apple for $3 billion, Apple can't let that happen, that he goes silent because Apple has a great image and so forth. So Dr. Dre did, you know, release another non-apology about his abuse and says that he's learned and so on and so forth. So in your work, all of that to say, in your work, do you see a difference between how white women victims are supported or believed in coming forward versus women of color and black women? Have you ever been confronted with that at all?
It's certainly there. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think all victims, regardless, face a massive uphill struggle. I really do. But there are certain groups, and it's always that double bind. They are maybe perhaps slightly more at risk. So sex workers, members of the trans community, these kinds of things. We know that these people are more vulnerable to offenders. And there's a double bind of they're perhaps less likely to be believed should they choose to report or feel less supported to be able to report to the police in the first place, because who is your support network if you're already so marginalized? And then a jury is looking at them one day and it's just like, you're just not the kind of victim we were hoping for. You know, because there's these things about you that we find difficult to engage in. So absolutely, all of these things, is everything is like to the advantage of the offender. And there's also that thing around the offender about their selection of victims as well. A lot of the psychology in terms of what they're trying to do in terms of power and control, the root of that for many offenders can be actually a fear of intimacy, a fear of women. It could also be specifically a fear of black women. And I think different communities have different fears around that. I think we don't have, it happens, but we don't have a huge issue with corrective rape in the UK amongst the lesbian community. But in South Africa, that's a thing. So what is it about men in South Africa that they still feel so threatened by women's sexual orientation that they're doing this to them? So absolutely, these different communities face different risks, and it's invariably the case that the more marginalized you are, the more risk you face and the less justice you're given.
Full disclosure, folks, Nina is white. So when you say certain marginalized people and so forth, and offenders really, you know, think about these things, we have talked quite extensively on the podcast about Daniel Holtzclaw, who was a police officer, Asian American, white American, who raped at least 13 women, was convicted of the rape of only some of them, but will spend the rest of his life behind bars. It was a big success because all of those women were Black.
Yeah.
He chose Black women who he assumed to be not believable, not worthy of going forward. Some, you know, really struggled with substance abuse. Some were sex workers. Some were just low income. And that's what he told all of them.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's how he used
his power.
No one's
going to believe you.
Right. Mm. So is it something that you consciously think about in your work, making people aware of the specificity of intersectionality, that it's not just enough that, you know, and that a victim is, for example, a woman. There are specific things that have to be taken into consideration if it is, for example, a trans woman, if it's a Black trans woman or a trans woman of color or these types of things. How do you work with law enforcement and other officials to make them understand that these things actually do matter?
Yeah, I think it's about helping them understand that for some offenders, that would be a genuine choice. I'm going to select somebody that if the worst case scenario happens, that this person reports. And we know people are not likely to report, but if they do, if you're a sex offender and you don't want to see the inside of a prison, you don't want that person to be believed. And so they will select somebody within society that they feel is not believable, not credible.
Right.
Someone that a jury is going to look at and be like, well, I believe the man over you. And so it absolutely speaks to society's prejudice when that person they choose is a Black woman or a Black lesbian, because there's something about you that means that people won't find your word against mine worthy. They're going to choose me over you. So we should absolutely see these things as a reflection of our prejudice. So we should be aware of them so that when, as a police officer, you're facing a report from a Black trans sex worker, you're thinking in your head, okay, this is perhaps a sex offender specifically targeting this group because they think that they're going to get away with it, and I'm not going to let them.
Do you have any maybe closing wisdom for people who find themselves discouraged after, you know, a big name like Keisha can be quite discouraging for anyone.
Yeah.
If you think this person has maybe not all the power, but certainly a lot more access than the average, let's say, person in general. It doesn't have to be a survivor or a victim. It has more access to means, to good lawyers.
You should bring a civil suit. Like,
right.
It costs money, yeah.
Since you say you work with everyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
What can you leave us with that may be something that a victim who's contemplating going forward needs to hear?
I think the key thing for victims is to know that you're not alone. And that you're not broken. And when it comes to your relationship with the criminal justice system, the way I see it is the system is broken, but that doesn't mean you are. So the people I know who have gone through the system, and maybe the system didn't deliver them justice, but they're still happy that they went through with it, their relationship with the system tends to be, look, I know the system is unlikely to work, but the person who hurt me isn't going to get away with it because I'm not going to choose to report. I'm going to play my part. My part in this is to report. And if the system is broken, that's the system's fault. But I'm okay. And I think that is a healthy relationship to have because it is true. So if you report and it doesn't even go to court, that does not mean that we don't believe you. It doesn't mean that it wasn't real. It's a reflection of our broken system. But I think that decision to report is a big one. It's something that you should think about, and Consider how it would be for you if you don't get justice, because unfortunately that is the reality. But things are improving, and I think part of this, there's good and bad in this story, the outpouring of support. And Keisha herself put a really heartfelt message on her Facebook page recently, just saying, look, I don't want this to put you off, your voice needs to be heard. And that's absolutely true, you're not alone. And it should be a message to our criminal justice professionals as well, as we know that most perpetrators have multiple victims. So why are there all these one person against word against another? It should be five people against one. We know 50 against one Bill Cosby. Like, let's help find the other victims too, because it isn't fair to have one person going up against an offender when there are probably others.
Oh yes, we always talk about that unknown, that uncertain number, that is well known and unknown remains unknown at the same time. Well, thank you so much, Nina, for reaching out. Thank you for reaching out, and thank you for taking the time today to discuss this. And unfortunately, I think we'll probably want to have you back at some point.
And that would be my pleasure too.
In our third segment, we'd like to talk about what's making us happy and what we're looking forward to. How prepared are you for that today, Denise?
You act like shit makes me happy. Nothing makes me happy. Oh, that's what makes me happy. Okay. You know that? Let me tell you something. What? I'm like the Eeyore in your life.
Okay.
All right? You like Winnie the Pooh. You like, oh, honey. I'm Eeyore, okay? Let's just get this straight.
Oh, my God.
Stand.
I'm glad it's on the record that you have called yourself, I'll use the nice word, a donkey.
A depressed donkey. Like, let's be real. Eeyore got severe mental health issues, yo. Eeyore needs to lithium some Paxil, something.
And I am a round, very happy to eat bear. I'll take it. I'll take it. So what's making me happy? What am I looking forward to? I don't know if it's making me happy, but I'm definitely looking forward to the Oscars coming up on Sunday. Why am I looking forward to it? Because I have taken the time to watch just about every movie that has been nominated for several categories. And why did I do that? Because I could do it for free. And I'm ready for all the critique. I'm ready. But mostly, I'm ready to watch Chris Rock, because I think he's going to bring it. He's going to bring it.
Chris Rock is woker the most, I will say.
Woker the most, but not super woke.
Not super woke. You can't be but so woke up in Hollywood. They will clob your butt back to sleep.
Yeah.
You're like, yo, let's take this breach of contract to court. So you can't be that woke, but I think he's going to put in some jabs. I mean, I don't know how he could put in more jabs than Richard Pryor did when he was hosting stuff, or that Eddie Murphy did.
But you know, he looks up to both of those people.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, he describes in detail how much he learned from both of them. So maybe he's trying to channel them. He completely went back to the drawing board after the nominations were announced. He said they had just finished writing the script. The nominations were announced. And he said, we got to go back and we got to do it again.
There's this sense that if white folks can laugh at something, then they could also understand it. Or that we just, you know, not specifically white folks, but that they can also understand it. But I live in the hipster, you know, white Europeans love laughing at black folks. They love
yes.
it. They love it. They love it. They just get off on that shit. And it doesn't bring them any closer to any level of racial enlightenment. It just means that they create racial ideas and memes and cartoons and whatever. And they are so edgy. They're so Charlie Hebdo. They, you know, they so girl. With the time. They so hip that they could be racist and get it. This is why David Chappelle canceled his show.
Oh, I know. Don't talk about it.
So at the end of the day, you know, Chris Rock, a comedian. I believe in the potential of comedy, but I believe it also has its limitations when we're talking about race.
Indeed. But I have to watch the show in order to have all my criticisms ready to go for our show next week. What are you looking forward to?
Tomorrow is a new day.
Okay.
And in that time, in the, tomorrow is full of possibilities.
Okay.
So
there you have it, guys. The wisdom, write it down, quote it, make a meme out of it.
Coming out. On Netflix.
Oh, my goodness. It's mind-boggling.
What do you mean it's mind-boggling? You know, I mean, I live in Austria, you know? I actually love it. Vienna just got rated the highest quality of white life. world again. Stop. So that's great.
Yeah.
You know, my quality of life happens mostly in my wonderful, beautiful apartment. I love it here. That's why I never leave it.
See, that's... Our listeners believe you're a secluse. Goodness. Well, that's all for this week. If you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today. So feel free to get at us. Until next time, peace out.